Your support is important to Living on Earth. Donate today by pressing the donate link on the left of this page. Every bit helps. And thanks.
20 years ago this week, the Berlin Wall was coming down, reuniting East and West Germans after almost 30 years. German Chancellor Angela Merkel marked the anniversary with a speech to the U.S. Congress. Merkel urged action to make a climate change agreement at Copenhagen possible. She called inaction another wall that must be brought down.
Once we in Europe and America show ourselves ready to adopt binding agreements, we will also be able to persuade China and India to join in. And then in Copenhagen, we shall be able to overcome this wall separating the present from the future in the interest of our children and grandchildren and in the interest of sustainable development all over the world.
But today, parts of the former no man's land along the Iron Curtain have come back to life in unexpected ways. Ashley Ahern visited one community nestled into the former militarized zone of the Berlin Wall, where people are redefining sustainable urban living.
If you walk the former path of the Berlin Wall, south from the Brandenburg Gate, you'll come across a gravel footpath on the banks of the Landwehr Canal. Pumping music will lead you under a bridge and around a wooded corner, and you'll find, tucked in amongst lush greenery, the squatter community of Lohmühle. But it's not just any squatter community.
I think squatting always have been, there's always been the aspect of taking care of the place and not just going in there and say, okay, we'll be here for a bit until the roof comes down and then we squat something else.
Piers Ewing stands near a large dome-shaped structure made of plywood and particle board. Two old deck chairs sit on a small stage. Behind them, a bedraggled black theater curtain shields the entrance to the building. Off to the right of the stage is a makeshift bar. It's made of particle board decked with palm leaves and thatched reeds, Caribbean style. A DJ spins records as Berliners talk and laugh in battered lawn chairs nearby. A couple of kids play in the grass.
What used to be a greenhouse in its former life and was built into a multi-use sort of stage and cafe building. So we are one of the few trailer parks to actually do things all year through.
By doing things, Piers means the public music, theater, and education projects that take place on the old greenhouse turned stage behind him. This community is more than a residential trailer park. Since 1991, the squatters of Lohmühle have worked to bring this dead strip along the Berlin Wall back to life. The city of Berlin has granted the squatters a permit to stay here because they are improving the landscape while educating the public about low-impact living. Piers lives here with 18 other people. They work as artists, teachers, shopkeepers, bike messengers, even clowns. Everyone uses an outhouse where they rely on microorganisms to reduce the smell and help break down the waste.
No one knows what they're actually doing, but apparently they're doing a good job.
The squatters carry water in buckets from the nearby canal to water their vegetable garden, which is tucked in amongst the 15 or so trailers out behind the stage area. Piers has installed solar panels on most of the trailers, making Lohmühle almost completely energy independent. They power the stage and cafe area with a generator, but there are plans to get a windmill installed soon. Anna Grischting is an architect who has been studying planning and sustainable development in Berlin since the wall came down.
This space used to be totally barren sand with weed killers, and now nature has reclaimed this space, and what their experiment is to cooperate with nature.
Grischting studies boundary areas all over the world, focusing mainly on the demilitarized zone in Korea, the Green Line in Cyprus, and the Berlin Wall. She sees this community as a prime example of how people repurpose the no man's lands created by international conflict.
It's interesting because it's a laboratory of ecological planning in these in-between spaces. And I think it's not only from the nature, but also these new communities or new ways of living that emerge from these spaces.
Piers Ewing doesn't see himself as a lab rat or even an ecological planner. But he agrees that without the Berlin Wall, there could never have been a place like Lohmühle. In the chaos that followed the wall coming down, the government didn't have the resources to squelch the creative energy that spawned this community.
With the fall of the wall, there was so much space, and they just, even if they didn't like it, but they just couldn't keep up with, like, getting everything paved and building fancy new places on all the places. They just couldn't keep up, so it was pretty easy to get things going and to get a long-term perspective. And I mean, yeah, it's getting harder, but it's still Berlin and not London or Paris or someplace like this.
For Ewing, Lumula is a patch of wildness in the urban environment. But it also represents a unique opportunity to live life a little bit on the wild side, outside of the rat race. He studied physics in college, but for now, Piers is happy teaching drums in the local community and working on his own musical projects.
If I put it on a financial scale, but I don't want to, I would be better off working a bit more and moving into a flat. I would have more time or more money in the end. Mm-hmm. If I work on the project, I decide what I do and not my boss.
Ewing's too young to really remember what life was like when his country was divided by the wall and the Cold War. But whether he understands it or not, he's part of the healing process for the city of Berlin. Among all the grand public buildings that have sprung up where the wall once split the city, Lohmühle represents an alternative approach to rebuilding after troubled times, and a new take on modern urban life.
Ashley Ahern's reporting was made possible by a grant from the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna. Ashley spent the summer traveling sections of the former Iron Curtain. Now she's back in the States and with us in the studio. Welcome back, Ashley.
Thank you, Jeff.
You know, I'm amazed by these examples you found. I guess you might call these accidental conservation areas all along the old Iron Curtain.
They really were. They're not planned. It was a complete function of the dark history of the period. As one professor explained it to me, you know, all walls represent policy failed. And this was really an instance where nature profited from that failure in policy. This was unused land.
Went into the vacuum, if you will.
Yeah.
And in some spots, it's almost like the no man's land there of the Iron Curtain became kind of the last hedgerow for animals seeking shelter from the development on either side.
Yeah, it's an idea that I think a lot of Americans, or at least I, had a really hard time wrapping my head around, that people really couldn't travel to the other side of this curtain. It really was a curtain of iron. It was about a 50-meter to 100-meter wide militarized buffer zone that people weren't allowed to pass. It had guard towers, watchdogs, landmines. I mean, it was a really, they weren't messing around.
Well, tell me about some of the places and people you visited along the way. Tell me about Kai Froebel. He sounds interesting.
Yeah. Kai Froebel is really an amazing man. I guess I describe him to people as a cross between the Dr. Seuss character, the Lorax, and David the Gnome. He's just a very, very committed birder, and he's been watching birds since well before the Iron Curtain came down. He grew up in a little town in northeastern Bavaria, right on the Iron Curtain. He could see it from his village. And he spent his days, his afternoons were early mornings, as it were, with binoculars walking along the militarized border, and the border police came to know him. However, the East Germans had a file about an inch thick on him because they thought he was a spy. Here he is out here with his binoculars and his little, you know, little green jacket, camouflage gear, the whole deal.
Yeah, sure, you're looking at birds, buddy.
Yeah, right. Yeah. But Kai, he really was. He was just in it for the birds. He cared really deeply. He was counting populations and really figuring out that they were taking refuge in this place that was surrounded by wheat fields on either side. So it was an important habitat. And he is the one who ended up starting the Greenbelt Movement. He realized that what he was seeing in his outside his own little village was happening all up and down the Iron Curtain, and this was a huge opportunity for conservation.
Wow.
Yeah, he is such an unassuming man, but he held a small, informal meeting right in 1989 after the wall came down and, you know, invited some friends from East Germany and West Germany, trying to bring people together. 200 people showed up. And ever since then, this movement has just taken off.
What do they think might come of this? Are they going to be able to link up sections along the old Iron Curtain?
They're kind of looking at it not as creating a new green curtain. That's not the goal. And a lot of people are nervous about that. They don't want to see this blocked off. They don't want a new division between Eastern and Western Europe. Kai Froebel talks about it as a green necklace, really, where we're given this wonderful opportunity with these chunks of green spaces along the former Iron Curtain. Why not try to create almost like a very thin Appalachian Trail type idea that would connect these chunks like jewels in a necklace?
And in some places, it really is taking off. The Harz National Park in Germany, you visited there. Wolves are actually making a comeback.
Yeah, this is an amazing place. It's kind of north-central Germany, a mountainous area. Well, not big mountains, but a really beautiful green patch in a pretty developed part of Germany. And this, you know, Goethe made this place famous when he wrote about Walpurgisnacht, which is where all the witches come from all around the world, and they gather in this one mountain, the Brocken, and they have a celebration with the devil. And it was left wild. Nobody was using this space. Nobody was allowed to use this space. And so now that the wall, the Iron Curtain, has come down, you're left with this green space, and the wolves are moving in from Poland, from Eastern Germany, and starting to kind of populate what they're trying to keep as a green space now. And of course, it's raising all sorts of controversy, just like it does here in the U.S.
You also visited Lake Neusiedl. This is on the border between Austria and Hungary. And I just love the sort of swords into plowshares kind of imagery here, where the old guard watchtower, people now use it for bird watching.
Yes. Alois Lang, who is a coordinator for the park, took me up one of these things with all my recording equipment. And it was a very, very nerve-wracking thing, not being a big fan of heights myself. But these towers really, I mean, you can see exactly why they had them. The lake is only about 3 feet deep. It's covered, it's surrounded by reed beds, which makes it a great spot for birds that use it as a major migratory stopover from Africa to the Arctic. But it was also a great way to escape from Hungary into Austria. And so you had people trying to come across this very shallow lake, and people from these guard towers would shoot them.
Do people visiting these places for the great nature, do they still get a sense of this very, you know, dark episode in human history, even though they're there for the natural history?
I think people only want a certain dose of dark history. I think when you're on a family vacation, you don't want to be talking about people getting shot from guard towers. But I think for Austrians, for Germans, this is a really important part of their history. And so being able to put a green light on it, a sort of a happier light on it, is a great way to kind of have your spoonful of sugar with your historical medicine, as it were.
Ashley Ahern telling us about nature's comeback along the old Iron Curtain. Thanks a lot, Ashley.
Great to be here, Jeff.
And for pictures Ashley took along the former Cold War boundary, go to our website, loe.org. Living on Earth is produced by the World Media Foundation. Our crew includes Bobby Bascom, Eileen Balinski, Bruce Gellerman, Annie Glosser, Ingrid Lobet, Helen Palmer, Jessica Elise Smith, Ike Shishkanjaraja, and Mitra Taj, with help from Sarah Calkins, Marilyn Gavoni, and Sammy Souza. Our interns are Quincy Campbell and Nirja Parekh. Jeff Turton is our technical director. Allison Lirish-Dean composed our themes. Steve Kerwood is our executive producer. You can find us anytime at loe.org. I'm Jeff Young. Thanks for listening.
Funding for Living on Earth comes from the National Science Foundation, supporting coverage of emerging science, and Stonyfield Farm, organic yogurt and smoothies. Stonyfield pays its farmers not to use artificial growth hormones on their cows. Details at stonyfield.com. Support also comes from you, our listeners. The Ford Foundation, the Town Creek Foundation, the Oak Foundation, supporting coverage of climate change and marine issues. The Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world. Uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org. And Pax World Mutual Funds, socially and environmentally sustainable investing. Pax World for tomorrow. On the web at paxworld.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.